Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 23rd, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And the usual two segments lined up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Judith Levine. I think this is her third appearance in this show for a new book, a prolific author. Her latest is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping, just published by the Free Press. And we'll talk about her the diary of her year in which she consumed only the minimum. Of things and what that felt like and what she thought about it and what, if anything, she's learned from it. And then at the bottom of the hour, and we'll play an interview recorded yesterday with Marie Trigona, who is a journalist based in Buenos Aires, who has a very interesting piece up on the America's program, the IRC online. Let's see, I'll get you the URL a little bit later. But it's a very interesting piece on recuperated enterprises in Argentina, which is a story of during the economic crisis of 2001, when companies were closing left and right across Argentina, a number of firms were taken over by their employees. The management left, the owners left, and they had intended to padlock the places and just have them drift away, but the employees took them over. And there's still close to 200 enterprises that were seized by their employees and continue to be run. Almost 200 enterprises employing about 10,000 workers. And it's not only in Argentina. There are also several of these pursuits happening in other countries in South America. So we'll hear from Marie Trigona about this very exciting and promising thing. Lots of interesting political developments happening in Latin America. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, which is, of course, a more traditional state-centered political experiment. But the Argentine one is much more autonomous. You might say, or anarchist, or worker-controlled, syndicalist, a non-state solution that doesn't depend upon traditional political parties or unions. And we'll hear much more about that at the bottom of the hour. And now just a couple of headlines before we get to Judith Levine. U.S. economic news, first of all. Existing home sales for the month of February, that is pre-existing houses, not new ones, a number reported by the National Association of Realtors, took a strong jump, an unexpected strong jump, in the month of February, the first increase after 4 months of decline, and possibly... it was unseasonably warm weather. I encouraged people to buy houses, although it's kind of unusual to make an impulse purchase of a house because the sun is shining. But anyway, that's one of the explanations for this surprisingly strong number. But that doesn't change the picture of a generally cooling housing market. Mortgage Bankers Association reporting earlier in the week that applications for new mortgages declined in the week ending the 17th by 1.6%. That continues a general downtrend that was established close to a year ago now. So that does one of the many signs of a cooling housing market. The great American housing bubble does seem to be losing some gas. This morning, the Labor Department reporting that its tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, people who've just lost their jobs and signed up for benefits, that was down 11,000 last week, much less than expected by most economists. The previous week's number was revised upwards. And so this number has been edging higher now for the last month or two, after taking a long decline at the end of 2005, now inching higher, suggesting that maybe we've seen the best for the job market and the best in this expansion has not been so good, as I've been saying here for months and months. Probably much to the boredom of listeners. And the weekly weekly measure, survey of consumer attitudes by ABC News and the Washington Post, steady last week, sort of bouncing back and forth in a mediocre range, up considerably from the post-Katrina lows of late summer, early fall, but just fair to middling number. So that suggests that the job market not booming. People feel okay about their finances, but they're not bouncing off the walls. But that doesn't seem to stop them from buying houses, one of the many contradictions of the American economy over the last few years. And the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which is designed to forecast moves in the U.S. economy, 3 to 6 months out, and a gentle declining trend over the last several weeks. So it suggests, if not recession, economic slowdown later in the year. The economist Christian Weller, who is with the Center for American Progress, reporting that the so-called middle class, which is a very mushy word, I think, which contains everyone from street sweepers to lawyers by self-identification. So it's a very broad and imprecise term. But anyway, let's call it the working and middle classes or whatever you want to call it. But anyway, he keeps a tally of how many weeks of work a worker paid the average wage would have to toil in order to buy a basic market basket. And that number in the year 2005, the highest since he's been keeping these records for the last 25 years. And that is not good news, although the economy is supposed to be doing well. It's not from the point of view of the average worker. And then finally, a report in today's Financial Times that the Hong Kong-based Li & Fung Trading Group, trading groups are basically companies that buy stuff in one place and sell them somewhere else, hoping to make money on the difference. They're reporting that price rises in China are beginning to become notable. China no longer the really low-cost source of manufactured goods, at least last year compared to previous years. They're saying a double-digit increase in Chinese labor costs, higher in oil and energy costs, slightly higher currency value, and this is beginning to drive textile and garment work, manufacturers out of China and into India, Bangladesh, and Cambodia. China, of course, a very long-term story, but that's an interesting development for everyone who thought that China was the cheapest place on earth. So let's take a little musical break I'll play this a bit of this song at the end of the show, but I was really taken by Willie Nelson's version of a Ned Sublette song, "Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other," which is a very fascinating reflection on gender identity and gender politics. That song, written by Ned Sublette, recorded and released by Willie Nelson, I think, in honor of Brokeback Mountain. So I did a little research into the career of Ned Sublette and found him to be a very versatile fellow. Spent some time in the downtown noise music scene here in Manhattan with the likes of Reese Chatham and Glenn Branca. Also does some country and salsa and just a very versatile fellow. So we'll hear one song from each of the sides of Ned Sublette at various points during this program. Let's start with this from his early 80s downtown noise rock phase. This is Radio Rhythm. Thank you. And then a little bit of Ned Sublette with the group Clandestine doing Radio Rhythm from the early 1980s, just recently re-released in a collection called New York Noise 2, a successor to New York Noise 1, which was a great anthology of all those late 70s, early 80s downtown noise rock art bands, a remnant of a time just after the fiscal crisis when it was cheap to live here and everyone wasn't an upbeat hedge fund manager. Now we're joined on the line by Judith Levine, who is a prolific author. I believe this is her third appearance on Behind the News to talk about a new book of hers. And this one is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping, just out from the Free Press. Welcome to WBAI, Judith.
Hi.
So, you went for a year just buying essentials. What inspired you to undertake this experiment?
Well, it was a combination of things. I started thinking about it, about doing the project at Christmas at 2003. I was schlepping my shopping bags. I dropped one into a slushy, icy puddle and thought, you know, there's got to be a different way. But I have been thinking about it since September 11th, when the president and the mayor came out and told us that the way to defeat terrorism and continue our great American way of life was to go shopping. That seemed like a cynical, depressing, and destructive way to think about patriotism.
Yeah, it's quite a change from our history, too. In past war times, we were told to tighten our belts and just consume essentials, and it was supposed to be a spirit of shared sacrifice, and now it was a spirit of shared excess. Did you get the idea of doing this as a personal experiment or as a book project, or did they sort of come together?
Well, they came together, and, you know, I didn't do this as a way to tell others how to live right, nor really did I enter this experiment hoping that I would never buy anything again. It was more in the way that, a biologist who's doing an experiment wants to figure out what is the effect of a certain factor. She removes that factor from the experiment and sees whether, you know, the animal dies. And so I wanted just to see what else would happen if my partner Paul and I decided as much as possible to withdraw from the marketplace of both things and experiences.
And did you have to encourage him, or is he a willing partner?
He's very willing. He's one of these people you have to drag out to buy another pair of socks.
You actually write about a pair of socks that was the super wool or the magic
wool? Yeah, the smart wool socks.
Smart wool, yes. Well, what exactly did you buy and not buy during this year?
Well, we bought what we considered to be essentials, which were, I have to admit, a rather rarefied and idiosyncratic list. We began, of course, with the ingredients for making foods. We didn't buy any prepared foods except for bread, so, you know, no takeout pizza, no Starbucks coffee. But we also bought internet access and insulin for our diabetic cat. A person might ask, why keep a diabetic cat alive in the first place? And we didn't buy any new books or CDs or go to restaurants or travel for leisure or go to the movies or go to the theater or buy clothes. And so, you know, clearly necessity is a very wobbly, the difference between necessity and desire is a very wobbly line, and it's completely dependent on where you live and when you live. So the Bangladeshi farmer might burn 1 quart of diesel fuel in a month, you know, to cook his food, whereas somebody who lives in Los Angeles and has to commute 40 miles each way to go to work would burn 6 gallons a day, and both of them would consider that fuel use to be a necessity.
Well, there is a movement of people, and I'm a friend of mine uses this quote from a Brazilian samba as his signature quote in emails. It's only intellectuals love poverty, poor people love luxury. You went to some meetings of the Voluntary Simplicity crowd. Tell us about
yes,
them.
Yes, we joined a group in Brooklyn, and Voluntary Simplicity is, I would say, you know, for many people, it's kind of useful. They feel that their spending is out of control. They can't afford the lives that they've got, and so they want a self-help group. But it's premised on, I think, a kind of moralistic idea, which is that it is bad, bad for you spiritually. It's immoral to be buying things. And so the idea is you clear your life out, you what they call declutter, and presumably at the back of your closet after you've gotten out the old tennis rackets and old shoeboxes, you will discover your authentic self. My authentic self, I worried, might have been a shopper. So one of the things that we soon realized when we joined Voluntary Simplicity was that in this group of 12 people, half of them had been laid off or were about to be laid off, and about a third of them were at workplaces where their coworkers had been laid off, and therefore they were working twice as hard and hated their jobs and were, you know, working 12 hours a day. And so these people were not necessarily voluntarily downshifting. They were being downsized. And I began to think, you know, is voluntary simplicity some sort of sop, you know, to the scarcity idea of the since the Reagan years, that there's not enough to go around and therefore everybody should buckle down and be thrifty? It felt to me like not the way, certainly not the way to solve the big problem of overconsumption.
Yeah, well, you write about this throughout the book, but you reflect on whether this is really a matter of individual choice and behavior or something socially determined. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Of course, all politics is personal, and everyone makes individual choices, and the things you do raise or lower your consciousness or keep you in denial about whatever is going on. And so I think that people, individuals who think about, say, the afterlife of their possessions may not throw out so many things if they realize that all of those cell phones are landing up in a landfill someplace. That said, overconsumption is a big global political, social problem, environmental problem, which needs to be solved by policy changes. I don't think every individual should be forced to have to make a moral decision every time they want to, say, buy a car. It makes more sense to me to have fuel efficiency standards that would prohibit the building of certain gas guzzlers. So you just wouldn't get to buy that car because that car wouldn't exist in the first place. Leaving this big policy decision, this big collective decision to those people who are susceptible enough to personal guilt is, number one, not going to solve the problem. And number two, it's denying people one of the only pleasures that capitalism really gives us.
Yeah, well, you quote your friend Ellen Willis, a writer I admire very much, as being rather critical of the attempt to disapprove of consumption, cutting
right.
Sort of left-wing Puritanism.
Right, that's what she calls it, the Puritanism of the left. And she sees it as part of a whole era of sort of enforced scarcity, or that is a feeling of scarcity, and a repression of all kinds of sensual pleasures, so-called hedonist pleasures. There's a way that both from the right and the left, one is made to feel selfish for wanting. And that wanting could be, you know, nice clothes or a new snowmobile or, you know, going to a theme park with your kids. Our culture is gives us very little of collective or political pleasures. You know, there's very little that we are offered here that we can go out and do for free and feel good about and feel effectual about. And so, this is another way, Ellen says, and I tend to agree with her, of sort of taking it out of the skin of individuals. You know, at the same time, though, I do think that we each of us have a responsibility to think about our own consumption, recycling, all of those kinds of things. So I see movements like Voluntary Simplicity as more of a kind of consciousness raising just in terms of the consequences of overconsumption. And yet, I just don't think that guilt-tripping people is effective, and I also don't like it. I tend to, you know, be in favor of the gratification of appetites.
That's Judith Levine, speaking in favor of the gratification of appetites, who is the author of the book Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping, just out from Free Press. But, well, you write about this, and I was wondering if you could reflect on this. What is it about buying stuff? Is it the thing itself, or is there something about the act of acquiring it, the anticipation of acquiring it? What is the psychological and emotional pleasure of the kind of overconsumption you're talking about?
Well, you know, there's an enormous amount of psychology out there about this, you know, everything from some sort of hardwired brain chemistry that, you know, makes us just like squirrels. You know, we want a lot of things in our little den. I don't tend to think of humans as being like squirrels or any other mammal or, for that matter, any other creature. But there is, I think, a kind of cycle of envy and what the anthropologists and sociologists call emulation, and that is you see what, you know, the Joneses down the street have. Now you see not just what the Joneses have, but what the Gateses have and what the Onassises have. And so people start to think that the good life is what those great, big, really rich people have. And so people do want to keep up in that sense. But, you know, desire is about what you do not have. It's always about what you do not have. And once it's gratified, there's yet another thing you do not have. You know, this is what Proust is about, you know, that as soon as you have the thing, you cease to really value it all that much. Now, I'm not saying this is true about everything. You know, you find a lover that you love a lot and you hopefully continue to value her. But, There is no sort of end to desire. It is, I would say, by definition, infinite. And so this is great for capitalism, especially an economy that's based, you know, 2/3 of whose GNP is based on consumer spending. When Keynes first talked about this pent-up desire that could be unleashed by easy consumer credit, he was not worried that people were going to use up their desire. He realized that the higher their level, you know, their standard of living, the higher still they would want it to be. And so you could just keep on offering them things, new things, and they would keep on wanting them.
Of course, he was writing the Depression when people were not spending money, those
right.
that had it, and many people didn't have any at all to spend. So he was trying to bring
right.
back a culture of excess.
Right. I think that it was not only offering people consumer credit that made the change, but there really had to be a cultural change from what you were talking about before, which was an ethos of thrift to an ethos of, you know, put off the payment until tomorrow and, you know, pay on the installment plan. That was not something that people were very eager to do.
Yeah, Keynes is very eloquent on denouncing all the Victorians of his day.
Yes,
so
true.
It makes for great reading, although it doesn't really apply to the United States of 2006. Well, it's been, how did it feel to forego buying lots of things? Did you suffer from want and envy the whole time, or did you achieve some kind of spiritual peace?
Well, I don't know about spiritual peace. I expected to long, I think, more for things, and I didn't very much, but I had other experiences that I hadn't expected. For instance, one day I was going cross-country skiing, and I had forgotten to bring my ski wax, without which the skis just don't work. So in the past, I would have put out my $7 and bought a new stick of wax, but which, you know, lasts for years. Instead, I had to ask the kid who worked in the ski hut for a couple of swipes of wax, and I began to obsess about this on the way there. How could I ask him? Would he, you know, this is so stupid of me, blah, 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 blah. I was putting myself in a position of vulnerability and of asking for help, which is practically an un-American behavior. We value so much autonomy and independence, and having a credit card or a few bucks in your pocket enables you to spend your way out of predicaments and not ask anyone for help. So I felt vulnerable and sort of infantile in the sense that I was asking others to help me. Another thing I felt was out of it, marginalized, sort of stupid, because I was not consuming the latest culture. I didn't see the latest movies. I didn't go to the theater. I didn't buy the latest books. If I happened to be able to get them out of the library, I was lucky. And so I think of myself as an intellectual, somebody who is on the cutting edge, who knows what's happening. And so my identity was curtailed, you know, by my decision not to buy anything. And so, you know, I would find myself sitting home watching The Bachelor, Adam Returns, on a Wednesday night by myself and think, my God, you know, it's come to this. So, you know, vulnerability, feelings of marginality, and also boredom, which was surprising to me because I don't think of myself as one who is easily bored. So you do see how much of just your daily life, the pleasures of your life, your identity, your cultural life, your family life, you know, even your political life, needs to be attained through purchases.
And finally, it's been, what, about a year and a quarter since your year of not buying ended. Has this changed the way you live now?
It has. I had to go buy some clothing for my book tour, and I went shopping 3 days in a row. When I got home on the third day, I had a call from Visa saying they'd seen some unusual activity on my credit card. But, you know, I think one of the things that this experience did for me was that because Paul and I had to go out into the public sphere for our meaning and our stimulation and our fun, we were grateful for what was out there, the public library, the public parks, all of those free things that we enjoy together. You know, it really changed us from consumer to citizen in a big way. And it also made us see what shabby condition the public sphere is in, which is a direct relation to the amount that we spend on private consumption and the amount and the structure of our, you know, tax system that leaves more money, you know, in our pockets and therefore less for all the things that many people otherwise can't afford to do. We just read recently that they're going to start charging people to use the public swimming pools in New York City. So that the more we privately consume, the less investment there is in the public sphere and in the public good. And this experience really recommitted me to the public good.
We live in a world of private wealth and public squalor, as Galbraith said long ago.
Yes.
We're just about out of time, but you're reading tonight at Barnes & Noble?
Yes.
What are the
Barnes
details
Noble
of that?
In Park Slope, Brooklyn. That's on 7th Avenue near 6th Street at 7:30.
Okay. Thank you for joining us, Judith Levine. And the book is called Not Buying It, My Year Without Shopping, just out from the Free Press. And let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Marie Trigona.
The night was clear and the moon was yellow and the leaves came tumbling down.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price and you're listening to WBAI, listener supported, non-commercial radio, WBAI, New York.
And that's 99.5 on your FM dial and WBAI.org on the web. And this show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. And let's take another musical break, take another sample of the varied career of Ned Sublette. This is sort of country salsa or something. Ghost Riders. From Ned Sublette's Ghost Riders, and we'll hear a bit more indirectly from him, a song that he wrote, recorded by Willie Nelson at the end of the show. Now, the first part of the program was mostly about consumption. Now let's turn to the sphere of production and talk to Marie Trigona, who is a journalist based in Buenos Aires, part of a collective, media collective down there, Grupo Alovio. And she's got a piece at the America's program website, americas.irc-online.org. And it's called Recuperated Enterprises in Argentina, Reversing the Logic of Capitalism, Marie Trigona. And I recorded this interview with her yesterday, and let's listen to it.
First of all, tell us about this Grupo Alovio you're with.
We have been working for over 15 years. Grupo Alovio is a direct action and video collective working with different worker struggles here in Argentina, and for many years we've been using video as another tool, we say, for the subjectivity for a working class, using it as a tool so workers can realize that they have tools to change their own subjectivity, to change their own destiny against exploitation and oppression.
To make them producers rather than passive consumers, then.
Exactly. The idea is that it can, that video can be used as a political tool to organize, to generate actions, as well as raising consciousness.
All right. Well, now let's talk about these recuperated enterprises, which I imagine is a translation of a Spanish phrase, because it doesn't sound like a native piece of English.
No, the actual wording is empresas recuperadas, which is recuperated enterprises or workplaces that have been taken over by the workers, workplaces that were abandoned by the former owner or boss, basically factories and workplaces that were shut down. And currently there's 180 of these recuperated enterprises up and running in Argentina, and they employ around some 10,000 workers.
All right, and this really got rolling because of the economic crisis of 2001. So talk a little bit about that background and how these enterprises got going.
Since the late 90s, Argentina lived through an experience where thousands of factories were shut down, and this is a nation that was the number one industrialized nation in Latin America. And in the late 90s and at the very beginning of 2000, it lived through its worst economic crisis ever, when unemployment hit record levels over 20%. So this is basically the context in which workers decided to stand up against the destiny of losing their jobs, maybe with a possibility of never finding another job, becoming part of the masses of unemployed workers in Argentina that sprouted out of the late 1990s. So part of the idea of taking over the workplaces was the main principle and the main motive for these workplace takeovers was workers deciding to safeguard their jobs, knowing that they probably would never have an opportunity to find another job and to be completely marginalized from the active working class.
Did this happen spontaneously as a result of the crisis, or was there some sort of pre-existing movement in this direction? What was the kind of ideological and organizational background for these takeovers?
Basically, in many cases, there were groups of workers that had very little organizing experience, labor organizing experience, or activist experience. And like I mentioned before, almost all cases, what these over 180 recuperated enterprises share in common is that the decision rooted from the direct necessity to safeguard their jobs. So it was a somewhat spontaneous reaction on part of the workers, but it was also in the context when masses of people came out into the streets to protest against economic measures taken by the Argentine government, the IMF, and other imperialist policies that were directly affecting most of the population at that time. And this is a spontaneous uproar in the streets, but it had base in years of direct organizing in neighborhoods with the unemployed worker organizations. So it was part of of an outpouring of different expressions of resistance in Argentina at the time. And then after the workers decided to take over the workplace, there became networks of different type of organizing initiative to provide these workers with different legal tools and political tools and popular support. So, you know, little by little, they created different types of organizations.
And one more background question. Was there any assistance from traditional political parties or unions, or is this a new kind of organizing?
As far as Argentina's traditional unions, they've taken on, in many ways, roles of accomplice in Argentina's privatization of public enterprises and implementing of flexible labor standards. So as far as Argentina's traditional unions, there was, you know, very little or no support directly on part of traditional unions or political parties. Most of the support that the recuperated enterprises they motivated was came from different autonomous sectors, meaning people organizing autonomously from different political parties or the state, popular assemblies that sprung out of the 2001 crisis, unemployed worker organizations, and currently there's been a resurgence of independent union organizing, workers organizing against bureaucratic unions and organizing independently of the bureaucracy and for, they call it classes combative demands. This is the type of support that the recuperative enterprises have counted on.
And what was the reaction from the Argentine international bourgeoisie at these violations of traditional property rights?
Currently, right now, there's a number of enterprises that are fighting against a wave of attacks on the part of Argentine bourgeoisie, meaning right-wing lawmakers, business interests, etc. And two of the most emblematic cases have been the Bauen Hotel. Bauen Hotel is a recuperated hotel that employs over 150 workers in the very center of Buenos Aires.
Which has a very important symbolic value, you point out in your piece, right?
Yes. The hotel was actually built in 1978 for the World Cup in the height of the military dictatorship, with public funds and public subsidies and public credits that were never paid back. And during the 1980s and the 1990s, it was the definitive emblematic symbol of the Argentine bourgeoisie. Political figures like former President Menem, you know, held numerous acts, Peronist parties. Your typical politicians, you know, following business interests. Menem, for example, was you know the president who brought in most of Argentina's neoliberal policies that caused much of the misery and unemployment that hit Argentina in 2001. So right now, what was before the emblematic symbol of the bourgeoisie has become Argentina's or Buenos Aires' political center, where worker organizations, unemployed worker organizations, community centers, etc., can hold meetings, can hold political events, can hold cultural events in this 20-story hotel with amazing installations that the workers themselves invested their manpower and financial profits. They kept on reinvesting into the hotel, and a hotel that in 2001, when it was shut down, it was completely ransacked. The workers had to clean and revamp the hotel from top to bottom, and this was done without any public, governmental, or public funding whatsoever. This is a complete initiative that the workers did themselves with the support of the community.
And I want to return to this the theme of the political and cultural side of this in a bit. But let's talk first about what innovations have the workers introduced in the way organizations are run, the sort of managerial hierarchy and pay scale. How are the worker mm-hmm. enterprises now, the recuperated enterprises, differ from what went before?
Well, in the case of Bowen, for example, a group of workers took over the hotel in 2003, in March of 2003. The workers, bit by bit, decided to, they were occupying the hotel with the hotel out of service. They began to rent out the services, and when they began to have some type of income, they decided immediately to reinvest that income back into the hotel. When they finally were able to create some type of stability in the income and to create new job posts, their ideology was to bring in former Bowen workers who had been fired or had left the hotel before the closure and family members. Right now, all of the cooperative members earn the same wage despite their professional tasks inside the hotel. While the cooperative has an administrative body or council, I guess you could call it, with an assembly voted president, vice president, treasurer, secretary, et cetera, who kind of manage day-to-day decisions. The political decisions and organizing occur in a worker assembly, in a worker general assembly. And another example is Anon, which is currently employing 470 workers. It's the largest recuperated enterprise in Argentina. It's a ceramics factory, and they have, in many ways, been at the vanguard of creating new democratic relations inside the workplace, where there's no hierarchy whatsoever. Everything is decided in a commission, and then later in a monthly general assembly.
I'm speaking with Marie Trigona, who is a Buenos Aires-based journalist, who is also a member of the Grupo Olavio, a media collective there.
I believe the ceramics factory provided some materials to the hotel, right?
Exactly. Which is a very interesting exchange between the recuperated enterprises. Last year, December of last year, the Bowen Hotel, they inaugurated the front cafe, which is a beautiful, beautiful space where any moment of time you can, you know, see different groups of workers sitting, having coffee, having a meeting. But on the floor is lined with high-quality porcelain tile that the ceramics factory donated. But it was more of an inner exchange that the workers from Zanon, which is over 1,200 kilometers from Buenos Aires. When they come to Buenos Aires, they stay at the hotel. So it was an exchange of materials that the Bowen Hotel offers their rooms for workers at the Zanon to stay while they're in Buenos Aires, and the workers at Zanon donated the ceramic tiles for the cafe.
Yeah, these enterprises that can be organized internally as democratically as they like, but they still have to operate in a system of competitive capitalism. How can they reconcile that contradiction? Is that a problem?
It is a problem, but one of the major challenges that these recuperated enterprises are facing is legal instability. In many cases, these recuperated enterprises, currently the Bowen Hotel, are constantly having to mobilize and organize against violent eviction attempts and threats of evictions that based on laws that have been passed. So this creates a constant state of instability which takes away numerous time and energy from production planning, internal administration. So it's in a lot of ways the legal crisis can create an internal crisis that's difficult to resolve. And in other cases, many of these recuperated enterprises are small to mid-sized businesses with outdated technology. And of course, the state has been unable to or unwilling to provide legal stability, let alone any type of funding or credits or subsidies that, of course, corporate businesses here in Argentina, they receive millions and millions and millions of dollars in subsidies each year from the government. So these are just some of the types of the contradictions, between the state and the recuperated enterprises. The state here in Argentina has been completely unsupportive and in many times, with a repressive response to these recuperated enterprises.
What about managerial technical expertise? Do workers look outside if they need that kind of expertise?
In many cases, as in the case of Zanon, for example, when the workers decided to take over the ceramics factory and to put the factory to produce, there was no administrative or technical staff who stayed. All of the workers who stayed in the factory were manual workers. So from production planning to sales to managing to technical maintenance, et cetera, the workers have had to organize all of this. There is certainly a deficit of professional input that can be trustworthy, et cetera, and even more so what we as a collective definitely think that there's a definite, and this is one of the major challenges facing the recuperated enterprises, is systematic skills training on formation for the workers inside the plant, so they don't have to depend on quote-unquote professionals, that they can develop themselves to solve any type of problem or technicality inside the plant or the business. So this is, kind of the diverse panorama that the recuperated enterprises are facing today.
Yeah, a great deal of the progress of capitalism in the last century has been about taking away the technical expertise of workers and professionalizing it or credentializing it. Have the workers been trying to address that issue and kind of roll back that portion of capitalist history?
It's, exactly the idea that these workers are proving that a boss, a manager, and certainly an owner isn't necessary to successfully run a business or a factory. That workers for centuries they're the ones who provide the knowledge, they provide the manpower, and it's simply the capitalist who organizes, puts a bit of capital, and takes away all of the profits from that are based on workers' knowledge and worker manpower. So it's the idea of reversing the cycle and proving that it's not necessary to have a hierarchical administration running a business, that workers can perfectly run a business themselves, because in fact they're the ones who for centuries have provided the knowledge for running businesses.
Yeah, it sounds like, given the legal hostility coming from the state and from capitalist class, that they may actually be afraid of the threat of a good example from these enterprises, showing that they don't need the bosses, they don't need the owners. You mentioned earlier that there are some cultural and political aspects to these new style workplaces. It's not just about reorganizing the way the factory or the hotel is run, but also engaging with the broader community. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I'm going to give the example of just last night, on March 21st, the Bowen Hotel, they had their third anniversary, and they had a little bit of a festivity inside the hotel, where obviously the workers from the cooperative and from other worker-run workplaces attended the event. There was recuperated enterprises, workers from recuperated enterprises in Brazil. Next week, a delegation of recuperated enterprises in Venezuela are going to be visiting the hotel to learn about the way Bowen has been organizing their business. But it was really exciting that in the festivities, there was workers, for example, a worker was performing music in a work shirt and work boots and at the hotel, and the idea of you know, workers being able to create their own culture, which means helping other workers realize that they have the tools accessible to create their own reality, to change their own destiny, that they don't need a manager behind their back looking over their shoulder telling them, okay, speed up your production, work faster, you're not doing it right. That the workers, they themselves don't need a boss or a manager to successfully run a business. So last night was a really exciting moment for the workers and for other organizations, for other unemployed workers, union delegates, et cetera, who attended the event last night. There was workers from the Chilevet printing factory, from Zanon, from a number of other recuperated enterprises, you know, celebrating the Bowen's third anniversary under worker control. So this is kind of an example of what, you know, what the workers have accomplished, not only politically in the workplace, but also culturally.
And then finally, what about, are there similar enterprises elsewhere in Latin America? Is this any kind of networks developing among them?
Yeah. Last year, we participated in the first ever Latin American Congress on recuperated enterprises, where worker-run workplace representatives from worker-run workplaces from Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Uruguay, they met together in Venezuela to do exactly that, share experiences, and also to create a broad network of support for among the recuperated enterprises. There was a number of trade accords and concrete accords of sharing knowledge. For example, the workers who are going to be visiting Bowen from Venezuela, that was one of the accords made at the Congress in Venezuela last October. But more than 30,000 Latin American workers are currently employed at cooperative-run businesses that have been closed down by bosses and reopened by employees. So there has been an initiative among this network and in different nations and in Latin America. So it's definitely an exciting moment.
It sounds like we in North America have a lot to learn from our southern neighbors. Thank you very much for joining us.
Not a little musical excerpt from the celebration of the Bowen Hotel's anniversary from Tuesday night in Buenos Aires that Marie Turgona was talking about in that interview. Marie Turgona, a Buenos Aires-based journalist and author of a piece on recuperated enterprises in Argentina, which is available on the website Americas Online, which is americas.irc-online.org. Marie Turgona, T-R-I-G-O-N-A. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Remember Judy Levine's book reading at Barnes & Noble in Park Slope at 7:30. Let's go out with this, the third side of Ned Sublette, this recording of a splendid song recently released by Willie Nelson. Cowboys are frequently and secretly fond of each other. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the night. Till next week. Goodbye.
Out on the plains of West Texas, there's many a young boy who feels things he can't comprehend. And a small town don't like it when somebody falls between the sexes. small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for me. And I believe to my soul that inside every man there's the feminine. And inside every lady there's a deep manly voice loud and clear. Well, the cowboy may brag about things that he's done with